You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I'm joined by Stuart Thornhill, Executive Director of the Samuel Zell and Robert H. Lewy Institute for Entrepreneurial Studies at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. A heck of a job title. Stuart, thanks for joining me. Perhaps we should start with, well, an adage, really. You can't teach entrepreneurialism. You either got it or you haven't. So surely it has no place in a university course.
Well, I think that's one that I hope we've largely debunked over the past 20 years that we've been building entrepreneurship programs. One of the, I think, a useful metaphor to think about entrepreneurship and being an entrepreneur is not unlike being an athlete. You know, we're all born with a certain amount of hand-eye coordination, for example. Now, some will immediately aspire to be professional athletes, and there's obviously something that they are born with. But being born with good hand-eye coordination doesn't lead you to athletics. You have to invest incredible amounts in time and effort in practice in learning your skill, in perfecting it and repeating it and all of those things. So having a predisposition towards being athletic doesn't make you an athlete. The more you've got that predisposition, perhaps the less hard you have to work to get there. But in something like business, you don't need to have laser reflexes. You just need to have a desire and an interest and a willingness to work hard. So I think one thing you do have to, and I don't know if you're born with this or you get it from your family, you have to be willing to work hard. You know, that willingness to persevere, to dig in, to put in the extra effort is significant, to take on some level of risk. And again, I can't speak to how much of that comes from your genes or your upbringing or just the way you see the world, but some risk is taken. But I think we all have that capacity, and after that, what we teach in university and in college programs is, what do you need to understand about economic models, about building and leading a team, about understanding what customers need, about making sure that you're able to build something to scale. So there's so much that comes from the knowledge base of being a successful entrepreneur that goes above and beyond just that willingness to work hard and take risk. And I think those are the two very narrow aspects people talk about when they refer to that. You have to be born with it. You have to be willing to work hard, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're not born with that, then I'll concede that point. But I think beyond that, there's an awful lot we can teach.
Sure. I mean, some people, though, and I'd include myself in this, no matter how hard you work, to use your sports analogy, I was never going to be a professional football player. I was never going to make it. Yeah. On the other hand, people like Zuckerberg over here, Richard Branson, will constantly be flagged up as people who dropped out of school and made it to the top of business, almost sort of delighting in the fact that they shunned that sort of training. They just had it anyway. Do you get weary of those stories sort of coming back time and again?
Well, you know, to really extend that sports metaphor, that would be pointing to the Kobe Bryants of the world, or the Ronaldos, right? They are the 0.0001% of entrepreneurs who make it to that level of fame and wealth, just as the 0.001% of athletes make it to that level of fame and wealth. You know, there aren't that many Rory McIlroys emerging in the world of golf, but there's an awful lot of people who can play a pretty decent game. And you know, in the U.S. alone, there are 500,000 companies starting every year. And that doesn't mean you can't be an entrepreneur and you can't be a very successful entrepreneur, but the odds of you being the next Richard Branson are about the same as being the next Rory McIlroy. Those are very, very long odds, and those are exceptional people. But there's, you know, the population's large and there's lots of room for success. But in fact, I think in some ways that's a bit of a challenge for those of us educating students, is to reset their expectations sometimes, that failure doesn't mean not being Mark Zuckerberg. Right. You can be very, very successful, build a great company, and never achieve. In fact, you know, there's, you know, a Zuckerberg per generation. You know, this is not a kind of a normally recurring phenomenon.
Sure.
And so, just understanding that, you know, success has a lot of meanings, and calibrating yourself on being the next Elon Musk might not be any more realistic than calibrating yourself to be the next Richard Branson.
Mm-hmm. The Ross Business School has a very strong reputation. Is there anything you see in the way HEIs, higher education institutions, approach teaching business, teaching entrepreneurialism, that is perhaps incorrect, things that universities are getting wrong?
Well, in some ways, the very things that entrepreneurs have to do can be antithetical to the fundamental things we teach in conventional business school classes. So as an example, in a marketing class, you may start with the objective of achieving a certain amount of market share, which you will go after by advertising, by new product introductions, by expanding your distribution channel. We have all of these tools, and we lay these out. Students are taught to do very careful risk analysis, consider the cost ramifications of what they do, you know, do calculations, use data, all very solid problem-solving techniques. And they're often given a cost of capital, risk premium. You know, they will cost you, this is the hurdle rate that you have to get over in order to pursue your innovation. Now, with an entrepreneur, you have none of that. So it really requires a changing of the mindset instead of how am I going to achieve this specific objective given all of these tools and data to, given what I know and, you know, the things that I'm capable of, what might I achieve? There's a friend of mine, a colleague at the University of Virginia, Sarah Sarasvathy, who coined the phrase or the term effectuation, which is effectual thinking, this idea of what effects can I cause with the things I know? If I know a little bit of coding and I have a friend who, I'll give you an example of this, which is a great one. Three former students of mine got together, walked into a bar and had a beer. It sounds like the setup of a joke, but literally they did one evening. One of them was a former police officer. One of them was a former IT programmer and coder. And the third was a marketing guy who had worked as a test prep instructor for GMAT prep company. And the three of them got together, and what they came up with for their company was an online test prep site for aspiring police officers, how to get past the entrance exam. So they took what they knew, their skill set, and combined it, and then created something that was of value to people. Now, there was no market to analyze, there was no cost of capital, there was none of those things. It was simply, what can we do to create value, find something to make someone's life better, in this case, aspiring police applicants, and then introduce that to the market and let it grow. And it's been a very successful company, but you wouldn't have necessarily seen that using the traditional tools that we would teach. It really requires starting at a much more micro customer focus scale and getting away from the big frameworks and the big industries that we traditionally teach.
Your example there is an example of a success, no surprise. But I know one thing you've written about and spoken about before is the importance of teaching students to fail, I guess. I mean, can institutions sometimes be a bit guilty of perhaps mollycoddling students, you know, trying to dissuade them from experimenting just for sheer fear that if they get something wrong, it will put them off their studies, put them off their what they thought, you know, the career that they thought they were going for.
Well, not only that, but you know, it's something that I think the most watched video on YouTube is Sir Ken Robinson on how schools kill creativity. TED Talk rather, not YouTube, but the most watched TED Talk. And his argument is you suppress creativity by enforcing this idea of right answers and wrong answers. And that extends directly through the entrepreneurial realm at the university. If students don't get good grades, then they don't get the option to interview with the companies they want to. So if you build in a mechanism whereby failure is treated the way it normally is in a classroom, then obviously people are going to shy away from that. One of the ways we've tried to approach it in our programs is setting up parallel programs for students to experiment and learn, which are co-curricular. They're not part of the curriculum necessarily, but they can invest time and energy. We'll put money into their companies through investments and grants and competitions so that they can try all of these things without having to sacrifice their grades, if you will. But I had a great conversation with we had a summer intern who was working at our institute over the summer, just going to his final year of high school, and he gave me his business plan when we had lunch, and you know, his expressed view was, I don't really expect this to work, but he figures he needs 5 to 7 startups under his belt before anyone will take him seriously, so he's going to start producing right now while he's 16 years old, so by the time he's 20, he'll have started and failed enough times that he'll have gone through the learning curve necessary. So his approach is just do it. If you get lucky, that's a bonus, but the expectation is he'll simply learn by the experience and he'll be better off as a result.
And he's 16, so he's not yet in college. Is college part of his plan, or is he one of these characters we spoke about earlier who thinks, I'm better off doing it than I am enrolling in a school at $55,000 a year?
No, he's in fact, he's applied to our undergraduate business program with the expectation that the things he will learn in business school, whether it's accounting, marketing, strategy, people management, all of those things, are the things that an entrepreneur needs when building a company. And that's often one of the, I think, the details that gets lost in those stories of the folks who drop out, is they're not alone. They build a team, you know, a senior management team that helps them grow that company. And usually they go to business schools to hire those graduates. They want to hire experienced CEOs. They want people with, whether it's undergraduate or business educations. They may be the idea person, but, you know, those companies don't come into being just as a result of one person's ideas. It's, you know, you need a whole lot of skills to make that happen. And the more you know, the better position you're in to make good decisions.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps we should talk a little bit about demand. You mentioned there's both undergraduate and postgraduate courses at the Ross School of Business. I think you mentioned just before we started recording that there's this slightly different trend in terms of the number of people to sort of applying to the courses at those two different stages of HE.
Yeah, so nationally, and I think globally, you can measure demand for graduate business degrees through the number of applicants writing the GMAT, the admission test. And over the past number of years, that number has been steady or shrinking. So fewer and fewer people have been applying to even write the entrance exam to get into MBA programs. And so as I think the degree programs have proliferated, the number of applicants has stayed steady. So as a result, there's more competition for the students that are coming into the program. Mm-hmm. So there's really an onus on business schools to prove their value and to differentiate themselves in ways that are meaningful, because as you said, it's a very expensive proposition and a significant financial investment. The undergraduate degree, I think, is becoming more attractive for a couple of reasons, one of which is its affordability. Undergraduate programs tend to be more heavily subsidized, particularly in the U.S. at the state level. And so the cost of a bachelor's degree is often a fraction of what it is to get a graduate degree. So right away, you're getting value for your dollar. But also, if you think about parents influencing their children's decisions, even the undergraduate degrees are not cheap. And so parents who are footing the bill for their parent, for their children to do a degree, I suspect maybe influencing them towards business or something, hard science, engineering, information systems, physics or chemistry. And while I personally think there's a tremendous value in a broad liberal arts education, I think the pressure of economic performance on the back end of the degree is so high that it's a much tougher sell for children to convince their parents to pay for 4 years of studying philosophy or literature than it might have been when it wasn't such a big economic price to do so.
Mm. It's still pricey, though, isn't it, for the undergraduate degrees? I mean, whenever we speak to people from U.S. institutions over here, you know, although the U.K.'s tuition is rising, you know, it's nowhere near as high as it is over there. What do you do to reach the students who perhaps wouldn't even consider applying to a university because the fees are so high? It's all very well giving scholarships out to those who apply and so on. But what about those who are put off before they even, you know, put their name on that form and send it in because they just see the sticker price and think, well, I can't afford that?
Yeah, I think that is one of the probably the most challenging self-perpetuating forms of discrimination is economic discrimination. And if you are from a lower socioeconomic bracket, and irrespective of race, color, creed, any of the other normal differentiators, you're going to be facing a significant disadvantage in trying to achieve any kind of higher education, much less in a business school, much less in one of the more expensive programs. You know, there will always be students who are exceptional and rise to the top and are able to get the full scholarships. But it's a barrier, and it's one that, again, will tend to perpetuate cycles on the economic side, because if you can't acquire the education to lift yourself out and to gain access to the better-paying jobs and the more lucrative careers, that's a tough one. And I think, a failure to break out of that cycle is not going to do anyone any good in the long term. It's a big structural barrier, and it's a problem.
And what about grad school level? So we mentioned earlier MBAs, sort of out-of-state fees, $59,000 a year. For those in-state, $55,000. Do you find that means that the makeup of that MBA course is from quite a narrow socioeconomic group, that there's a very sort of, everyone's pretty similar backgrounds?
They're similar backgrounds in that they tend to have been relatively high achievers. You know, these are people who have typically done quite well in whatever early career they've chosen, and are willing to take on what in many cases is, you know, $100,000, maybe $200,000 in debt to achieve a degree before they even earn their first postgraduate paycheck. So that tends to be one homogeneous factor, is just this A level of self-confidence that you can justify this investment. And I think to the extent that there continues to be evidence that there's value in having done so, that, you know, the options that are opened up to people having done the degree tend to be sufficiently lucrative and sufficiently enticing that people will continue to pay that kind of price for it. If that stops being true, if there is no possible way to justify it because the costs simply outweigh the benefits, that's when I think there will be a rapid decline in enrollment in graduate degrees across the board. So whether we've hit that tipping point or not yet, enrollment numbers would suggest we haven't. But again, how long it's sustainable at that level is anyone's guess.
Sure. And finally, I guess an open question: I mean, what's next for the business school? What you know, the next few years? What are the plans? What direction do you see it going?
I think we're really going to be doubling down on our investment in what we refer to as action-based learning. We invest a full quarter, an eight-week block of time in the first year of our MBA students program for them to go into the field, work with companies, and engage in projects that give them a chance to apply the skills that they've learned in the classroom. So more and more of that, an opportunity to have students deal with ambiguity, you know, less structure in their problems, put them in situations where they don't necessarily have the frameworks or they don't have the data they want, all of which is consistent with what we need to see in successful entrepreneurs, that ability to deal with the unknown and the uncertainty mm-hmm. of the problem. I think every university, and we're included in this, is trying to figure out the best way to leverage learning technologies better, whether that's through web-based seminars, through the use of technology in classroom settings, through the connection between faculty and students and between students themselves using the technology. It's so early now. Obviously, you've got MOOCs that are... I think being very successful in some learning applications, and this is one of those situations where I think certain types of topics and subjects lend themselves very well to one-way communication. You know, the simple lecture format works extraordinarily well for some settings. There are others, take negotiating or, you know, group problem solving or team dynamics, where I'm not sure there's a good substitute for being in a room, staying up all night under pressure and having to work your way through some tough problems with other people in the room, because those are the kinds of situations that will come up in the real world. So I don't think we've gotten to a point where universities are overnight going to become obsolete because MOOCs simply replace all of the lecture format. But if we don't figure out ways to be, back to your earlier question about the cost of tuition, to be more cost effective, you know, to use technology to reduce the cost of higher education and to increase the quality of the learning at the same time, schools that don't crack that are going to be the ones that are unsuccessful. And I think that's really where the opportunities lie, but those are big challenges for all of us.
Stuart Thornhill, thanks very much for talking to me today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.